This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Before the pandemic, Megan Stalter was an unknown comedian doing comedy shows all over the place, trying to get a break in acting and posting an occasional video on Twitter and TikTok. But once the pandemic hit, those videos became her only outlet. Stalter began producing them at a rapid clip, very short character sketches. And with everybody at home, on the internet way too much, she started to find a big audience, racking up millions of views. On social media, she became known as the Queen of Quarantine.
April 10th, 2 p.m. Central Standard Time. I just got back from an amazing date. I went to Red Lobster last night, and in between the Turtle Bay biscuits, I kissed the waiter. And then I got invited back into the kitchen to kiss all the chefs.
It's shot on her phone, and the props and costumes are whatever she can find around the house. Her characters embody the full spectrum of socially awkward and clueless. And suddenly, Stalter jumped from the internet to television as the worst assistant in the world on HBO's hit show, Hacks.
Okay, Kayla, yeah. You're supposed to be on mute.
Oh, I am. I just pushed the thing, bud.
Okay, bud, we can hear you, so you're definitely not.
Oh, don't worry, I'm not listening. I'm laughing at a meme.
You're supposed to be listening. We've talked about this. You listen and you take notes, right?
Yeah. So, okay, where's my notebook? Hey, I need to leave early. I have an adult ballet recital. Like, just, I can't miss this one because I missed last week. It just wouldn't make sense.
Michael Shulman is a staff writer who covers culture for The New Yorker. And he's one of the many new fans of Megan Stalter.
Am I getting it right that Hacks is your first professional acting job proper? Or
yes.
Were you doing other stuff? Yes. You just went from, like, nothing to HBO Max, huge comedy hit.
Yeah, I couldn't be more lucky. I can't believe it. I mean, that's, like, my first time on set. Like, that's the first time I was ever had, like, a professional acting job. And I haven't even done, like, a commercial.
So Hacks, for people who are not caught up on it, it centers on this old-school Vegas headliner comedian named Dipper Vance, played by the amazing, truly amazing Jean Smart, who hires a 20-something comedian named Ava, played by Hannah Einbinder, to kind of punch up her act and be her assistant. You play Kayla, who is an essential part of the show. Can you describe who Kayla is?
Yeah, so Kayla is, so Ava has this manager, and Kayla is the manager's assistant, and she's a bad assistant.
Kayla?
Mm-hmm.
What is in this coffee?
Half and half in sugar. Well, Splenda.
Okay.
A couple of Splendas.
That's not sugar, it's all chemicals,
yeah.
And I take natural sugar.
Yeah, brain,
all right,
F-A-R-T.
All right.
is your phone ringing or something?
I don't know, let's find out.
She's kind of party fashionista, silly, rich girl whose dad owns the company. So she has this privilege and power.
Hi. Hello.
Daddy's at work.
So how's my baby girl doing? Huh?
She's unbelievable. Really special.
You know?
Special.
She kind of sees Jimmy as they're kind of like equals, even though Jimmy is her boss. But I think she sees them as like coworkers, and she kind of lives in her own world and doesn't even realize how privileged she is.
Yeah, she's what the internet would now call a nepo baby.
Yes. She's, and yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Hacks is very much about this generational divide in comedy, with Deborah Vance representing the kind of old school punchline heavy Joan Rivers school of comedy. And then Ava is the kind of less crowd pleasing, more jagged millennial Gen Z kind of comedy. I'm curious if you see your own work in those terms, if you feel like you're on one side or the other of that divide.
My hope is always that my stuff can be understood by people of all ages. I feel like I draw a lot from the kind of older comedians anyway, like kind of like an a sort of one woman show in the 80s.
Right.
Like, I don't know, like an older woman doing like a Vegas style, like one woman show is kind of like my inspiration. I like performing for people that like, I don't know. I like to hope that people of all ages can be on the inside of the joke. I love Hacks because I feel like there's something for everyone in the show. You know, and I think Paul was saying a lot that a lot of times people tell him like, oh, this is like the show I can watch with my mom and like she loves it too. Because I think any sort of, I don't know, comedy is so subjective, but any sort of art that's like not including or alienating a huge group of people is, I just would rather not. I would rather not alienate any age group or like type of person. I feel like Hacks is something that people of all ages and like gender would be into because there's something kind of for everyone in it.
Now, how did you start performing? Was there a kind of spark where you felt, oh, I have to be on that stage?
Yeah, I really never remember not wanting to perform. I can't ever remember a time I wasn't making videos. Like when I was little, we always liked making videos, me and my siblings and my cousins. And anytime there was like a talent show or a Christmas pageant, I'd like be desperate to be in it. And I remember my choir teacher gave me like a solo for the Christmas pageant, and I just practiced the song over and over and over again. It was just probably two lines of the solo, but I was so like, oh my God, I just really needed to be on stage. But I do think that I've always been sort of weird, freaky, silly. Mm-hmm. I definitely didn't fit in high school, you know, besides like drama club. And I auditioned for everything, and I would like research the role, and I would get like, you know, prepare a lot. And I never got the parts that I wanted, probably ever. But I did play Helen Keller's mom in The Miracle Worker. And I didn't even get that part. I was an understudy, and then they let me have it because the lead dropped out or something.
Really?
Yeah. But that was probably my shining role. Like, she had lines at least. But after high school, I did think like, I mean, I didn't have any money saved to move to LA or New York. And we don't, you know, we don't come from money. And I just like went to different community college programs, and all I really wanted to do was perform, but I just couldn't even see a way. But then finally, like after trying a bunch of different things, like teaching, nursing, like missions, church work, like I did Bible school. And
you did?
Yeah, I was really involved in my church, and I was like, well, if I can't do what I really want to do, then maybe God wants me to like choose something that's like, you know, like helpful, but a job where I know I can make money after college.
So pre-pandemic, what was your life like? Can you just kind of describe what you were doing, what your state of your career, of your life, where you were living? What was going on?
Yeah, I had just moved to New York like 6 or 7 months before the pandemic. And I was having the time of my life, like on different shows every night, and it was like, I was like, oh, this is the dream. This is the New York dream. And I think that's when I first started getting any sort of traction online. I do remember right before the pandemic, my first couple videos that had ever gone, not viral, but like a lot of people were watching it more than normal for me. And I think one video was, I was playing like, it was like woman in the movie who almost hooks up with the lead before he goes off to find his real true love or something like that. And it was like,
oh, I remember that one.
Tim, we don't have to do this. You're a good guy and you're in love with somebody and it's not me. So go get her. I'll be okay. I have blonde hair. I'm fine. Go get her.
And I was like, oh my God, like, wow, I'm really doing it. I'm in New York and I'm doing these shows at night and I'm like, people are watching my stuff online. But then I think the real attention came with the pandemic. It really changed everything, and it was not focusing on trying to get people to see it, to be honest. Like, I just was doing these really crazy themed Instagram lives every night because I was so alone, and I was like, this is a fun way to feel like connected. Or even like posting stuff, I'm like, oh, this is like a creative outlet because we can't perform live right now. And it was really scary and sad for me. So I was just trying to stay afloat. I was just trying to like not lose my mind. It was just, it was so scary. But then like things were happening for me too online.
Yeah, yeah. It's this weird combination of like a horrible moment for the world, good time right. for Meg's career. I want to look at one of the videos that went really viral during the pandemic. This was from June of 2021. It was a video for Pride Month.
Hi, gay. Happy Pride Month. We are sashaying away with deals. This month at the Butter Shop, we're running a special deal. If you can prove that you're queer, you get 3 pints off your choice of creamed, chucked, or drowned butter. We love gay, and it's awesome.
That video, it was like, I literally was like rushing out the door. It was Pride Month, and I've just seen so many ads just from places that would never normally do like a Pride thing. And it just was like, I don't know, something clicked where it was like, God, that would be so funny.
We have been making butter since 1945, and we've been accepting all people since the last 4 months. So yeah, we're gagging for you to come take a taste of Cecily's butter chop. At Cecily's Butter Shop. My friend's mom, I think is gay. So we think it's cool.
I mean, it's obviously a great satire of how companies co-opt the language of pride to sell products during June. But to me, it's what's so funny about it is that it's more than that. It's like you see this character who's just so unused to being on camera, just kind of trying and failing to be presentable and pull this off.
So the whole thing, I'm reading off the computer. So all of what I said was written, but I think it was, I normally do like to improv with the videos, but that one I was like, it'd be funny if it looks scripted and like looks like I'm reading off a script. I think what I'm like drawn to when I'm people watching or getting inspired to do like a character is people that are really fully themselves, like, out loud. They're different than everyone else, but they are, like, so themselves that it doesn't matter what other people think of them.
Well, there's something about your characters that they sort of, like, represent the breadth of American idiocy. Like, there's this one video I love where you play a woman in her car who has just been to Starbucks and is so outraged.
Yeah. And I'm stopped right in my tracks. And, yeah, she goes, yeah, happy Halloween. Happy Halloween. That's what we're saying. She goes, yeah, happy spooky season. I say, oh, well, the only thing spooky to me is the fact that y'all are celebrating the most wicked holiday. And yet when I come over here in December 11th, when I come over here December 24th for my, you know, Christmas Eve drink, all I get is happy holiday. Happy holidays. Happy holidays. We're neutral. We're neutral. Happy holidays.
And of course, like, we all have followed these people who get outraged about the war on Christmas or whatever. And in a way, online culture has just opened up everyone, has made everyone a kind of on-camera performer. And you do really capture the sense that so many people are performing for the camera nowadays who just kind of aren't up for it. You can see them trying and kind of failing. It's like we're all performers now.
Right, everyone feels this pressure. Everybody wants to be famous or go viral. And it's fun to make fun of and to explore, like, why do people feel that way? Why do people feel the pressure to do that? That's what's so funny about these front-facing video characters because, like that video, a lot of people thought was real. Because, like, and that's
really?
What's so funny. Yeah, like, I think my favorite characters to watch are people that feel real. Like, even if they're not like bonkers, they just feel like, oh, well, I know that woman, like that church woman, even though she was saying crazy things about the Starbucks employee and celebrating Halloween, she's so real.
So what kind of things were people saying on Twitter who thought it was real?
People were upset with her, this character, and was, you know, saying like, the whole like, you know, wow, like, I don't think a Christian should be yelling at a barista, or like, you don't, you're not the real kind of Christian, or like, you know, I don't think God would like that. And the other thing is, I really like the low quality of the videos because it almost feels like the person's even more real because it's like they filmed it themselves. And when you, the fun thing is about, is like you can prank people because people don't, if they don't follow you, there's so much of that content now online that yours kind of just, you can put yours up and people think you're serious. And that's really a part of the joke for me.
Megan Stalter spoke with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman. You can see her in Hacks and the new series Queer as Folk, a reboot, which premieres in June. You can read Michael Shulman at newyorker.com. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Helen Rosner. I'm a staff writer at The New Yorker, and I mostly write about food and cooking and chefs and cookbooks and things like that.
For a foodie like Helen Rosner, heaven is spending the day in the kitchen with another serious cook.
Hi!
Hi, Helen.
It's so good to see you.
Good to see you.
Learning new dishes and techniques and talking about their favorite subject, even or especially when the conversation is just not fit for broadcast.
I was asked I don't know how much I could swear here, fuck, marry, kill, pasta, rice, bread.
Oh my God.
I know my answers. I'm very curious about yours.
That's really hard.
So hard.
Okay. I think I fuck pasta.
Fully.
We are fully fucking pasta. Can we just, like, sacrificially kill potatoes and keep both rice and bread?
Look at you going rogue and bringing in potatoes. Like, potatoes coming to me like, wait, I wasn't even a part of this narrative. What is happening here?
Recently, Helen went to visit Andy Baragani at his home in Brookhaven, New York.
I met Andy Baragani a decade ago when we were working at the same food magazine. Even back then, Andy had a pretty impressive career. He'd cooked at Chez Panisse in high school. That's Alice Waters' famous restaurant in Berkeley, California. But you might know Andy from Bon Appetit's YouTube channel, where he brought his personality, his flair, to every video and dish that he made. Growing up, the gay Iranian-American kid in California who watched Jacques Pepin and Julia Child and Martin Yan on TV, Andy had no idea where his blossoming love of food would take him. He's recently published his first cookbook. It's called The Cook You Want to Be, and it's explosive, but maybe not in the way you'd think. Andy fills the pages with tiny changes, little tricks, tiny adjustments, small lessons that transform your cooking from everyday home cooking to really restaurant-level dazzle. It's like adding lemon zest to your breadcrumbs, which gives them acidic and floral notes that totally changes the game. When you watch Andy cook, you also kind of want a pencil and pad right next to you so you can jot down little notes about every little thing he does. So where did this book begin for you? When did you start writing this? Because you've been cooking professionally for like 20 years or 15 years.
15 years, yeah. The book was actually had a different name for a moment. It was The Cook I Want to Be.
Ah.
And the book was going to be even that much more personal, kind of taking on, telling all the stories throughout my life. And while there are definitely still, you know, personal essays, I changed the I to you. I wanted to bring in the reader. I wanted to extend a hand. And I didn't want it to just be about what I've gone through. I wanted to kind of pass those stories and those lessons to the reader so that to empower them and so that hopefully they could find out the cook they want to be.
I love the way that you approach sauces in this cookbook. I'd love to talk to you about that a little bit too.
Yes.
You open, one of the first sections in the book is just a collection of all-purpose sauces. And they're not what I would expect to see in a collection of all-purpose sauces, where like you might expect to see, well, like here's your marinara and here's your pesto. But instead you open with like this shocking lemon and shallot vinaigrette. And you don't even suggest putting it on a salad. You suggest using it on top of grilled vegetables or roasted meats.
Yes, I think it's really when you have a pantry full of great sauces or toppings or sprinkles, it elevates the dish. You don't need to do much to the dish. You can roast some vegetables, and if you have a good sauce, it kind of ties it all together. There's a section for tangy things, which is called a hit of acid, creamy sauces, green sauces, crunchy toppings, fiery sauces that are to add some heat. I think it's always helps to have a few sauces in your back pocket.
Are there any lessons or tricks or recipes or ingredient pairings in the book that were revelations to you that you learned from someone or that you discovered and that just sort of made your eyebrows shoot up and you went, oh my God, this is it?
Oh my God, now my Rolodex is going through. I rarely want to roast pistachios because it dries them out or removes their freshness, and I want that tender creamy inside, so I leave them raw. Or I take my panko breadcrumbs, which you'll see later today, to the point where they're just almost burnt, but I don't burn them because I want that deep toasty nuttiness from them. Cook your seeds and nuts in fat, so you have this beautifully fat toasted nut, but then that scented leftover fat as well. I don't even know. To always save your pasta water. There's so many things. There are too many things.
So now that you've gotten to know Andy a little bit, let's cook. What are we making today?
So today we're making this cauliflower ragu with lemony breadcrumbs. And it doesn't have a lot of ingredients, but it has a lot of flavor. And it kind of mimics the texture and flavor of a bolognese, but without the meat.
So we're here in the kitchen. And on this electric stove, you have two big pots. One is slightly taller and more narrow, and one is slightly wider and shorter. What are these two big pots for?
I have two pots set up, which I am a firm believer in for pasta. If you're cooking for four people and you're cooking anything more than 12 ounces of pasta, you have to have a two-pot setup. What that means is you have a pot of boiling water for your pasta and then a pot for your sauce and where your pasta will eventually end up and finish.
Not a skillet, but a pot.
No, even a very large skillet or a large skillet with the high sides, it still, to me, doesn't do the trick because there's too much going on and... the pasta will get messy, the sauce will go all over. You want a large pot. I'm telling you, it is a game changer, I promise.
Revolutionary.
So we're just heating some oil up in the same pot where you're going to make the sauce. Heat that up over medium-high heat. You'll be adjusting the heat if it goes too hot. And then you're adding half a cup of panko, Japanese breadcrumbs. And you're just going to let that sizzle and toast, and you'll see how it'll gradually change from this kind of pale, just almost off-white color to golden, to then this like deeply, deeply toasty, crunchy breadcrumb.
Oh, that it happened. They totally just crossed the line.
See?
They meaningfully got darker.
Right there. It's like takes it, and people really would pull like 20 seconds before, but this is, I think, where... It makes all the difference.
So, dicing the cauliflower.
Yes. So, you're taking a whole head of cauliflower, and if you have a food processor, you could just remove the florets and throw in the stems and just pulse it until it. You kind of get these kind of bitsy pieces. They don't need to be even. You want that kind of irregularity here.
And it's bigger than cauliflower rice. It's not like teeny tiny little grains.
Definitely.
They're like chunks.
Yes.
Small chunks.
Small chunks. And then you'll set that aside. A little bit of prep work, slicing the onions, slice one red onion, and then quite a bit of garlic.
Sauce pot.
Sauce pot, you're just heating up more oil up, and then once that's hot, I add the thinly sliced onion and garlic.
You take the onions in this step a lot farther than I feel like I'm used to taking my onions when I'm making a pasta sauce. Like, really, like they're browning on the edges and getting...
We don't want these onions to be blonde and juicy and soft or jammy. We want them frizzled and brown in spots and that kind of caramelization. And then anchovies, which, you know, you can omit. You don't have to put it in, but...
I think we should even give people that option.
Okay, I take that back. You can't... You have to use them. I'm sorry, everybody.
They add so much. They're essential.
It fools the people who are tasting it that are not the cook that it's been cooking for a long, long time. And then I add half a cup of tomato paste.
It really does get incredibly dry in the pan when you just have this deep, dark, brick red onion, garlic, tomato jam.
And I'll say, like, you'll be very tempted to add more oil because... The pot will look dry, and you'll see how the tomato paste is beginning to stain some of the oil, but don't. That's when you kind of add the cauliflower. And then you're going to add your pasta that to the pot that has not cooked all the way. It'll be a little bit too crunchy, but you'll add that pasta and... a good amount of pasta water. I always save my pasta water, but I'll start with a cup and a half, which is a lot. But because your sauce is not really a loose sauce, it's a paste. So you add your pasta water. They're not two separate things. It's not pasta and sauce. They need to marry and come together. And this is where it's essential to kind of take the time. It's gradual. And then we throw in the butter to kind of add that another layer of fat.
Oh, wow.
And that takes it to really another level because the sauce has so many things going on. Even with the few ingredients, it's garlicky, it's oniony, it has all that anchovy flavor, it's spicy, it's tangy from the tomato, and the butter kind of soothes everything and allows really all those ingredients to kind of shine and come through and stop fighting one another. And then you just plate it up in bowls, and you have that toasty lemony breadcrumbs, and I am a big fan of carbs on top of carbs.
I love it. So how do you feel about people who add red pepper flakes as a finishing spice.
I don't understand it.
I don't understand.
I'm very confused because most red pepper flakes are just have no heat to them. They need to kind of come back to life. I feel like they've been living in the aisles, depressed, sad, and just they need to be awakened. And they need that heat and that fat to kind of come alive. And if you just sprinkle on it, it also it tends to be too coarse. So if you're sprinkling it to finish, I would grind it up at least. Not with your fingers, but really get in there with a mortar and pestle or a spice blend.
Andy Baragani is the author of The Cook You Want to Be, and he spoke with The New Yorker's Helen Rosner. And that's The New Yorker Radio Hour for today. If you're making the cauliflower ragu, don't burn the breadcrumbs and let us know how it goes. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Mengfei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.